Welcome to the Sinner Story podcast. This month we share with you a discussion about the most fundamental element of a screenplay, its concept. Recorded at Sinner Story 2012, in this session pro-writers Mark Fergus and Philip Eisner discuss what makes for a great concept. Between them, Mark and Philip have been responsible for films such as Children of Men, Iron Man, and Event Horizon. The first voice you hear is that of a Sinner Story staffer asking a question relating to concept and brevity, and the first response is from Philip Eisner. Enjoy.
Is it absolutely equivalent to brevity, or is there another ingredient?
No. I mean, really, it has to be brevity. I mean, a good example of this is you take a great film like The Matrix. You could not pitch The Matrix. You couldn't pitch The Matrix then.
Yeah.
You can't pitch The Matrix now. Why? Won't fit on a 3x5 card. The easiest concepts to set up is if you are an established comedy writer and you come up with a high comedy concept. High comedy being Jim Carrey as a lawyer who cannot lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't need to. It's like you're an established comedy writer. We know that you can write comedy. I got the concept. Here's some money. Go do that thing. Adam Sandler is. Whatever.
But I always remember your, because it was the best pitch I ever heard, and you said you had gotten a job based on what, a 3 or 4 word pitch, which I feel like is a great way to launch into concept.
Well, that was Event Horizon.
Event Horizon, and I remember, I believe it was The Shining in Space.
Yep.
Is a movie. There's a movie right there, and so packed with so many. Brevity, for starters, and I do believe brevity is the key, because not only because they don't really process many words, but also it's like the movie cooked down to the point where it can't be any more pure and any more packed with promise. And you're promising the moon, the stars, the sun, and everything else in 4 words. That's like the ultimate concept, and I feel like even though it's really hard to get it that precise, it's something everybody should try to do, is to find out what your concept is. And for lack of a better way of defining it, is what's the essence of your story that can't be reduced any further word-wise or emotion-wise or whatever, but I guess because it's movies and it's Hollywood, that blows people's imaginations away. It can't just be an interesting idea. It's like, you know, it's an exploration of mortality. Okay, that's really short, but that's not going to get you a movie made. But you find a way to knock people out of their chair with the way you present your idea. It promises a whole movie in that many words, and it's really hard to do. I'm not pretending it's easy. I find it nearly impossible to pitch, because it's about reducing. But I'm going to call concept the crystal that has the whole movie contained inside of it, and that really just it just promises so much. It's a promise of what this movie, this story is going to be, and it's a good promise. It's a promise that people immediately say, "Wow, I want to see how you can pull that off."
And part of the promise, right, is that it's not actually all the information. It's not giving them any reason to say no, because if you go into detail, and this is, again, we're talking, concept and pitch, I think, are two different things.
Yeah.
You need to know what your concept is, even if you're not pitching. People always talk about, should I be able to pitch? Pitching is a great skill. You have to be able to sell yourself in a room. You have to convince people to part with money, etc. And it's hard. And pitch format is constantly changing and it's constantly evolving. So when people go like, well, should I learn how to pitch? Or sometimes in the LA area, they'll be like, oh, come to this, give us your money and we'll teach you how to pitch. And personally, I think that's a big waste of time. And the reason I think it's a big waste of time is right now, if you're not an established writer, you're not gonna sell pitch. And if you do sell the pitch, you're not gonna get to write it. They'll hire one of these guys to write it. So I think it's more, but you always want to learn how to sell yourself if you can find a way to sell. But to go back to what I was going to say, the great thing about The Shining in Space is there's nothing there for anyone to sit there and go, oh, well, I don't like that choice. I haven't told you what my choices are. I haven't told you what the characters are. I haven't told you anything.
Exactly.
What you're seeing is like, wow, that is a movie. And that's very important, because a lot of times people will come in and we think about stories and we think about characters and we fall in love with these things. And they may be great stories and they may be great characters, but they're not movies. They're just not. Maybe a great book. It could be a fantastic book. Does that mean it's a good movie? I don't know. I'm waiting to see how Anna Karenina does, because frankly, watching a woman be depressed for 400 pages and then throw herself on a train is... You know, I wouldn't think that was a movie, yeah, but apparently.
I think, and Gatsby, for sure. I'm dying to say, I mean, love the book. Just don't know what 3D and Baz Luhrmann means to Great Gatsby. I can't wait to see.
But and actually, that's a good example. In these things, a lot of times people go, well, what about that movie? What about, you know, here are these movies, and these weren't high concept science fiction or Adam Sandler comedies. And, you know, things like Great Expectations get made. And like, yeah, Great Expectations gets made every 5 to 10 years because it's a famous book. And so a lot of times when people go, well, I really want to tell this human drama and this epic, and it's set in the 1920s, and it's about this family, and I'm immediately going, okay, unless there's suddenly going to be a crime drama and there's bootleggers, you need to write it as a novel, because there's not a market for a spec drama screenplay.
No.
Which does not mean you're wasting your time, by the way, at all. Because the fact is, a novel has a beginning, it has a middle, it has an end. You've got the same act structures. It's just that your acts are, your first act of your average 400-page novel is about 50 pages long. And you have to use more words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're allowed to use more words. So, yeah, I think... I'm just thinking of concept. It's not just marketability, it's... That will come later. I've been pontificating to everybody this weekend about how marketability as a goal is always, it's never served me in any way, because it sort of sets a, I'm going to write something that will sell, or I'm gonna find out how, it's just always backfired, or you're always late for the train by the time you've discovered what everybody's looking for, it's already way over with or moved on, and so it's never been a useful goal. So. But I always try to look at, in terms of concept, is what is a story that I can boil down to, and totally key thing is when you're presenting a concept or pitching a concept, if it's good, or if it's interesting, the more you start explaining it, the more the magic starts to fly away and questions start creeping in and what ifs, and a concept should be something that's just purely magical. As what the movie, you hope the movie will feel like when it's done. It will feel like this was pulled off, and then you have to go. The job is to go make that happen. But to come up with an idea that hasn't been done before, or hasn't been combined in a way that it's ever been combined before, that's just evocative as hell and makes them feel movie. And I guess the thing I learned from McKee, at least I think it was him, the idea that there's concepts with built-in irony, things with clashes, things with, even the concept has tension in it. It has irony. It has things that are fighting each other already in a beautiful way that you say, I've never seen that play out before. I've never seen that combination before. But it has to be evocative emotionally. And I think Joe was saying it yesterday, and it took me years and years to realize that it's just about. It's about visceral, emotional excitement and gut reactions to things. It's not about your intellectual brain being explained something. It's all about, like when you hear a concept as cool as that, or you hear a concept for a good story, you have a physical reaction immediately. You don't have you don't think about it. You feel it first, and then you think about it later. And that's sort of the goal with these, I think, anyway, because I don't trust the brain anymore. I think it's sort of really late to the game, as it were. It's not really what's truthful. It's shows up later and tries to tell you why something works or doesn't. But it's that instant excitement, like the acting teacher said, like the cat doesn't think about jumping for the bird, or the people don't choose to fall in love. That kind of thing. It happens, and that's kind of the seduction I think you want when you choose a concept, is that it has that initial, it just has an immediate reaction to people, because that's why I feel like people should test their ideas out on, like if you're wondering what you want to write and you have four ideas and you tell people about them, you know which one people lean into. It's people are curious, they want to know more about that one, and you start to see that's a story that people instantly connect with emotionally, and then they ask me more. That is something I rely on more and more, as I feel like if you spend time on any idea you can make it a good script, but which ones by nature are just more interesting to people, it's cool to test them out on people.
And which ones are visual by their very nature?
Yeah.
It's like if you, returning to my Russian novel analogy, I really love Crime and Punishment. I was reading it again recently, and I realized that novel takes place entirely in Raskolnikov's head. And the actual events filmed are young man in his 20s wandering around the city, without any money, and eventually on his long moody walk going to this pawnbroker and murdering her with an axe, and then continuing to walk around for a while until he confesses and goes to jail. And, you know, his relationship with the girl, it's nothing that should justify 800 pages.
Yeah.
But it's this internal narration. That doesn't mean that you can't do a film version of it, but the film version is going to be a huge divergence from the environment that's portrayed in the novel.
Otherwise, you have a guy wandering around the city looking very tortured, but after a while, after a very brief amount of time, you want something cinematic to happen.
Yeah, something. You know, again, it's and a lot of that. One of the great things about film is that you can make the internal external, whether it's through fantasy sequence or just literally by going, no, we're going to externalize the internal conflict.
Yeah. And that book, it's why great novels often make crappy movies, or you know, the attempt to do them there has to be some radical rethinking. I think they should. I think Shakespeare would love to see this stuff that's been done in his name to make his work cinematic, or the experimental version. I think the idea of recreating it for the time and the place and playing with it, it's not unholy text. I think that would really, he would love that. I'm just guessing, because he seemed to have such a sense of, you know, this is an audience. I mean, we want people to witness
see
us
laugh. He was not writing. I mean, he had to keep the royals happy so he wouldn't be killed.
Yeah.
He's writing, the people who are paying his bills are actually in the penny seats.
Yeah. Yeah, and that idea that a book is, so I think that's one of the key distinctions of why great internal literature is, you know, I was just talking about Children of Men, which was like, you know, not a literary landmark of any, but it was an internal novel that we got the job to by saying Casablanca. It was saying this is an internal, ponderous, dark novel that not a lot of physical action. Take the internal conflict, the monologue inside, you know, someone struggling with, do I take action or do I lie down and die? Casablanca says, well, the woman who broke your heart now walks into your life and says, I need your help, I need this, you have connections, go help me. And you're like, I don't even want to see you, what do you mean? Like, how dare you walk back into my life? And then this person, our hero, is in the power to help someone, doesn't know what the end game is yet. Helps her, finds out that this is about nothing less than the fate of the entire human race is at stake here. And then when he loses her, holds the promise that he made to her, reignites his hope, all this shit, you know. But none of it's in the book as an idea, as a concept. And the way we got the job, and they said, this is a movie, guys. And I think the reason we got the job is because nobody wanted the job, because it was one of those, what are we going to do with this? Another good way to just a little career thing is go for the stuff that no one cares. Go for the stuff that no one's chasing, because there's great stuff that people are ignoring that are great potential movies. And if you're chasing the stuff that Steve Zaillian's chasing, you're definitely not going to get it. But if you find the stuff that has potential, that's how we started our career anyway. I diverged, but the idea was bring a movie concept to something that's not cinematic and activate it and bring it out into the world. Bring stuff out of people's head, and you're doing the same thing. Just tell it in physical space with people and things, and obstacles that are real. And all we did was take an internal novel and make it. I mean, Casablanca to me is the greatest love story ever, because it's like you have to give up the most to prove your love for someone. You have to give them up and give up everything you wanted to show your love for someone. And that was what was sort of lurking in Children of Men, but not on the page per se, but it was the thing that they were missing to turn it into a movie. So it was not an irredeemable book to go into the pile of the books that never get made. It was something that gave them a concept, like we're talking about. Like it gave them a concept to wrap. Everybody loved the fascinating story about humanity dying out, but so what? It could just be a. Where's the drama in that? Everybody's dying out. There's rationing. There's the power is being shut off. People are pretty hopeless and dreary. People are throwing themselves in front of trains because they're depressed. They're having, there's no drama. They're like, where's the drama? Hey, here's the guy who can turn it all around if he steps up and gets involved and helps this woman who hurt him very badly. He can change the world. Then now you have a story. So that's really helpful to the idea of this idea of concept. Is it's gotta be active, visual, cinematic. It's gotta have turmoil in it, otherwise you're gonna be writing a book, and that's a different thing.
You also said something that kind of just sparked this thing. It's always in my head when you're talking about the brain comes late in the game, and one of the things with the concept, and this is very hard because writing is ultimately it is a left brain exercise. Mm-hmm. It is a logical, language based exercise. Watching a movie is a completely right brain exercise. It's using the visual part of your mind to process the story. And there is an inherent conflict between the two. So anyone who's writing a screenplay is basically doing the mental equivalent of yoga. You're trying to unite these two opposites. One of the things when you're going through there is you have to be aware that a screenplay in general, and I'm talking about not so much the concept, but the overall, it's got to hold together enough so that the analytical left brain of your mind shuts up. Because if it doesn't hold together enough, and we've all seen movies like that where you're into it, and then there's something happens on the screen, and you just sort of sit back and go, well, and suddenly you're out of the story.
Because
it's like, yeah, it's like, fine, whatever. I mean, I remember pissing people off in the theater when I was watching Tombstone, because it just went into slow motion for no reason whatsoever, and you're charging through the water going, no. And I started laughing, and God turns around the thing, he's like, shut up. And I actually was arguing with someone that I was I'm being rude, but I'm arguing with him like, what, you can't be thinking this is good, come on. But I actually liked Tombstone, but it was like I was totally into the movie, these great performances, and then they just made this choice. It was like, this makes no sense. But the flip side of that is the concept has got to appeal to that intuitive right brain. It's the thing that makes you go, oh, because the left part of your brain is also the part of the brain that makes you go, no. When you're pitching a story, or when you're trying to sell your script, when your script's being analyzed by the reader, by the producer, by the executive, and these are people that want to make your film, but the thing is, when they're doing this, what you're asking them to do is get fired. Because if they make the film, and that film flops, they're fired. So that's all you're asking someone to do. Give up your livelihood for my story. That's what you're asking them to do. And you go to an executive. They're looking. They don't want to say no. They actually want to make movies. They're looking for movies to make. It's in their interest to say no. It's in their self-preservation to say no. And when they're reading it, unless there's that thing that makes their left brain go, oh my God, this is going to be so good. Oh my God. Because the left brain is going to be sitting there going, I don't care what the script is, I don't care who did it. They're going to find that thing, they go, that left brain has got, you've got to have given them that thing's like, yeah, but think of the, and that is always undefined. Because it's this emotional gut reaction that, like, you know, when you think of, and I've never read the script, so I don't know, but you can just imagine reading all the reasons you would have when you're reading the original script of The Matrix to say no to that, how expensive it's going to be, how they're going to pull this off. And even though, okay, we let them direct Bound to see if they could direct Bound. Oh, Bound's really awesome. I guess they're directors. But still, it's going to be so expensive, and it's a huge risk, and we're going to do that. And you go back, and you, I can just imagine reading that opening scene with Trinity and that fight with Trinity, culminating with her lying on her back, and you don't know whether she's good or bad, but then she says, get up, Trinity, get up, get up. And suddenly, she's still just as much a black-clad terrorist as before, but now she's talking to herself. She's terrified of this guy that's chasing her. She's just done all this stuff. And she's terrified. I'm going, get up, get up. And I just imagine after that, they're just like, yeah, the second act is totally expositional. Yeah, all this, we've got to make this movie. We've got to do it. We've got to find a way. This has to be on the screen. And again, one of the reasons that a lot of times we'll talk about action movies or big movies or science fiction movies is because the gestures are big and they're easy. It's very easy to analyze an action film and break that down. But a lot of times, once you nail the concept, you can do that for character drama. I always joke around that like in a comedy, in a romantic comedy, that, you know, in an action movie, there's the fight scene. In the romantic comedy, there's the wedding. There's always the wedding, and the wedding is a set piece, and it's no different than a fight scene. It's no similar than a gunfight, except now it's the wedding, and you've got the woman and her rival. And it's always going to build. It's not going to be outside the saloon. It's always outside the church or the justice of the peace or wherever they're going to get married. But that's it. It's just that in a romantic comedy, the stakes are romance and marriage and love. And in a gunslinger, it's, you know, honor and life and death. It's like, oh, look, we're men. We kill each other. Look, we're women. We out-flirt, out-think, out-to-do, whatever. I'm not very good at that whole...
Yeah.
I like the blood and...
Yeah. Hunting and killing and
stab. Yeah. Stab with knife. Yeah.
That's pretty much what women do.
Stab with knife.
Well, it's, yeah. I watch my kids turning sandwiches into weapons. I'm like, all right, it's hardwired. They're 1 and 3 and they're already fighting using sandwiches as
that is so awesome.
They like as crashing spaceship. I'm like, they don't even watch violent stuff. Like, it's just hardwired to me crash things together, you know? And it is what it is. So Hawkhead, as my writing partner, said that he never had one of his sons come up to him. He just had a daughter, and she marches up to his bed one day, pushes him away, get up, get up. He finally wakes up, and she's standing there with two dresses in her, in one in each hand. She goes, I have nothing to wear. He's like 3.5 years old. He goes, my sons have never... So, and I guess this is not really a diversion, because it all goes down to this hardwired subconscious world that's all this is. We're just trying to capture a dream state in a story that I love that way of putting it. Tell the left brain to shut up and just take the ride. That is so important, because your left brain is always there. Yeah, but you know, and if you can just shut it the hell up and go with the magic, that's every good movie ever made. I mean, and
give it enough. You gotta give it enough.
So just the logic so nobody notices. Hey, you didn't cover me logically. Now I'm annoyed that doesn't make sense anymore, and now I'm focusing on that, and you lost me over here. That's all concept, pitching, making the movie, writing the story. It all comes down to following the magic subconscious impulse to want to watch a story. Everybody wants to be taken away somewhere, not intellectual and not. They don't want to experience that part of life. There's plenty, we can watch the news for that or whatever. They want to be taken on a journey emotionally, and it's all like, it sounds like such crap to not refuse to answer the question specifically, but who the hell can bottle like what the magic thing is? It's your best idea that you wake up in the middle of the night and write down on a napkin. It's your subconscious screaming to you. That's where all the good stuff is, and if we can capture that and harness that to a story, you got a good movie.
Yeah, it's like the Tao that can be known is not the eternal Tao. It's like, you give me a god that you can define, and that's a god I don't believe in.
Right.
You know, it's the same thing. It's and one of the frustrating things is there's this desire for formula and structure. And one of the things, and this is in teaching in UCLA, I remember I had one student, and she nailed the formula. She was actually a very good writer. But it was this thing of she was doing everything right.
Yeah.
Why is this not working? I'm doing everything right. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. And the answer is, like, there's no magic thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes it just takes you 8 drafts of a script to realize that, this story doesn't sing.
Yeah.
It doesn't sing. And what do you do? It's like, so I wasted all that time? No. You had to write all of that to discover that this is not a story that's sing. How would you know if you didn't do it? I mean, it may sound like a waste of time, but it's not.
Yeah.
You're sitting there like, oh, I've got this idea, and it might really be good. Well, this is how you find out.
Yeah.
You do it. You go to work on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I interrupt real fast? This is a good thing to get on record. So if you two guys follow paths that turn to be dead ends, does that happen frequently?
90%. Most of the time, yeah.
You know, an interesting
thing. I think that's kind of shocking.
And the thing, too, is like what you call a dead end, it's like, for me, it's like, I remember I've got one idea that I've had, and I've never finished the script. I wrote like a couple of scenes. I figured out a pitch, and my idea was without going into the story. But I always thought, wow, this could be like a very cool, low budget Cronenberg-y version of the Frankenstein myth. So I was just playing with it, and I really wanted it's like, you know, slow paced, character driven. And I pitched it to my agent, my manager, and they really liked it. But they're like, oh my god, this is so good. And I'm terrible with names. She's the really beautiful South African actress. Thank you. So Charlize Theron's looking for her next project, and we've got we'll attach it to her pitch it, but you've got to make it bigger because it's got to be a big studio film. And literally between, I was so into this, and by the time I drove home from that meeting, which you'd think it'd be like, oh, I'm so excited, literally all the joy had leaked out.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a big studio film. This was a small meditation on this guy who's being brought back to life and the psychiatrist working with him. And now they wanted to be big, and now it was going to be set pieces, and now it had to, you know. And suddenly I'm like, oh, I don't want to do it. And I know it sounds like crazy because, like, wow, you could sell that to a studio and make a little bit of money. And it's like, yeah, but I'm not thinking of that. What I'm thinking is sitting by myself in a room for months on end now trying to write something that it's not what I want to do. I don't want to sit there and go, big set piece. If they had just said, that sounds great, let's pitch it to Charlize Theron's Bernstein, and never said, big studio piece. If they said, like a Charlize Theron, and she's like Monster. If they had said like Monster, I wouldn't have written. I would, if they want to pitch it, that's fine. I would have spec'd it for her. Because I was just like in love with it. Now, is that thing dead? No, it's not. I got about 50 pages of it sitting on my hard drive. One day I might come back to it, but not right now. And there's a lot of things where you'll explore and you'll write scenes. I don't know if I've ever had an idea where I just started it and I was like, oh, this is terrible. It's more like I start it and I lose interest.
Yeah.
It's like it never hits that critical mass of, and usually for me it's like, I'll be like halfway through a first act. And I like outline and write a first act somewhat simultaneously. But if I don't get to that end of the first act, and usually if I hit the end of the first act, even if I haven't finished the entire story or if I've written the ending, but like, as I'm writing the end of the first act, I'll usually jump and go, and the climax of the movie is this. And if I don't get there, usually it's about page 15 or 20, I'll start, what are you doing? I was like, are you writing? Yeah. What are you writing? Skyrim. Skyrim.
Yeah. They take off or they don't, or they are kind of like, that's how it should be. You should be getting on the trail of something that's going to go to the magic place, or you realize, oh, you know, now my other brain's starting to take over, or now I'm starting to see all the problems with it, or now I see why, oh, at the end of the day, this is exactly the same as a movie that's already been done, and even as good as it can be, it's always going to be a pale shadow of that. You know, you kind of find the, but you don't be afraid to go down the path and see where it goes. But most of them, and the great thing about writing stuff that doesn't go anywhere, I use everything eventually. You know?
Oh hell yeah!
You write a greatest set piece in the world, doesn't work, and you're like, Lara Croft Tomb Raider. You know, I got a 10-page bridge train helicopter thing that's going to
blow. Oh, yeah, exactly.
Like, cut. Everything, man.
And, like, and there'll be, like, you know, something that doesn't work, and it's, like, suddenly you're in an action scene, and it may be, like, a huge piece, or it's something like a gag, you know, this particular part of a gag. And not, and again, the town's very, very different. Like I've said in any of my private meetings, it used to be there's like all this money floating around to develop ideas, and now it's just that part of the business does not exist. There's not a form of it. It's like now they figured out that, well, if you'll pitch it to us and you really love it, you'll write it for spec anyway. Mm-hmm. We'd rather pay more for your spec than buy a pitch that we don't know if we want or not, and we actually still sitting on libraries of stuff we have.
No.
So a lot of times... But what happens is when you are pitching for a property, let's say someone else owns a property, and by the way, sometimes a lot will say, well, you spec this for us, which personally for me, for you guys, in honesty, if you're trying to break into the industry, you don't have the luxury. I always find it amazing that people who own a property have the gall to ask you to spec something that you won't have any claim to the rights to. It's like, wow, so I'm going to spend the next 2 or 3 months writing a script that you can say yes or no to that I can't travel with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that's quite a commitment.
But that is actually the state of the industry right now. And in fact, there are some established writers who are sitting there going, fuck it, I'll do it.
What's the union rate for the minimum person to do that?
Zero.
They have to pay
zero.
2 months.
Zero.
That's zero. Zero. That's what spec means. That's spec means.
And they're asking it. I mean, it's the guild would be pissed if they, you know, a lot of stuff goes on that the guild would frown on, but it's survival. You say, you know, a bunch of really good writers are gonna take a crack at, you know, outlining, do a treatment, maybe even a whole draft, just because they want the job bad enough and they're willing to do it, and you're not, so you're out of the game.
Yeah.
And then if you do it, you're taking the risk that. But yeah, the payment is zero, and it is zero until they like it. They say, yeah, maybe a deal gets put together, and then eventually you get paid. You know, but that's a big if. And I'd say. I don't know. I haven't thought about it recently. It's kind of depressing. But about 10 to 15%, maybe 20, of my workload, my toil, my sweat and tears, the hours I spend, and the weight that I carry to work, 20% of it pays. The other 80% is spec, and or stuff that goes nowhere, or you know. It's effort that, now if I knew which 20%, I'd say to myself, well, you have no idea which 5, 10, or 20% is going to pay. You got to do it all. And hopefully, in the mutual fund kind of way, something in there will pay the bill.
Right.
But you don't know which chunk of that time, effort, energy is going to pay. So when I think of, it's actually a good way to think, because you say, I have to do 100% of it to get that 10%. So if you're not willing to do the 100%, then you're out of the game completely. If you get mad at having to write for free, then you're never going to get the good 10% that's going to pay your bills. And I wish I knew how to hone in on where is the money going to end up, and what's the waste of time, because I'm always wrong.
Yeah. You know? I think it's just it's the scatter. It's like exactly. Yeah. It's one of those things of when do you know to do the work for free, whether you're speccing a script for free, or whether it's just a thing of. Yeah. I'm breaking a story for you for free. I'm doing a treatment for free. Yeah. I'm doing the character break. You know, I'm doing everything but the script for free.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it is like, you look at the property, and it's like, is this a property that you're taking this meeting because they like you and you like them, but frankly, you're going in literally as a hired gun. So it's like, if there's a property, and it's like, well, I want to work. They have a property. They want to make this movie. I'm taking the meeting. I've got ideas. They could work. Is it that, or is it, or are they... And they did this tonight. It ended up, it's not, I don't know where the status is, but they were doing this a while back, and they were doing Dune. And that's what they were doing for Dune. And I was furious because I was in a project at that point, and I couldn't pitch. That was one where I'd be like, I'd write a first act, I'd do a character breakdown, I'd do a first, it's like, Dune? It's like, no, I don't do anything for free, and I don't do this for free. It's like, well, do Dune, fuck, I'll write the script for free.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll do it. I'll do it, and then you make it or not. It's like, just do it. Fuck, it's Dune.
It's like, you know, like, that's how you decide whether or not to take the chance. Do you love it enough? Will you happily work for free? I'll do that on certain projects, you know, like Philip K. Dick, James Elroy, whatever. If I said, you got to spec an outline or a draft to even show up at the party, I'll be like, all right, I'll do it, you know, because you want that project means enough to you.
Fuck, Man in the High Castle.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Might be
Like, I mean, just about anything.
Most amazing film.
So many things that in that catalog that eventually will get done right, but I would totally, you know, I would even turn down a job if I knew it was a possibility. Yeah, you gotta say, like, what's for the love of it and for the job, the gigs of it all, you have to constantly be, you know, making those choices. And, you know, and you know, when you get a few credits and you are making steady income, which we have been for, you know, about 6 or 7 years, it's still the same. Still, I thought it would just get easier and everything would clarify and it would be like you'd be working on one project at a time, getting paid very well. And then you go on to the night. No, it's still chaos. It's still a shitstorm. 20 projects flying around, 3 on spec, 1 can we please meet on, you know, 1 you're working on, 1 you thought we'd be done with 8 months ago. It still won't go away like a bad flu, or it just refuses to get done. And it's always chaos. I never have been able to, like, say, oh, I'm working on one project. So you got to embrace this sort of the idea of working on multiple things in multiple stages and being, like, kind of loving the chaos of it, because it never really gets easy, I think.
I just got to, it's not, and I have to offer, like, just a slightly different aspect. I have this spec that I've been working on, and it's been this thing that I work on, and just when I'm getting into it, just like, to work on something else, and literally it's like in the third day that I've turned my attention to it, I'm just completely, the rest of the world is
in it,
falling away, and I'm focused on it. I get the phone call, we need you to do a tweak of this, or we got to do this, or it's like, oh, we've got a different, we're going to go towards this part here, and it's like, attention over here, and attention over there, and finally, and it's actually this fall, it's like, you know, my agent manager on the phone is like, well, we're thinking about, and I don't usually lose it, and I wasn't, like, angry at them, but I was just like, no, I'm not available. I'm just not. I'm going to finish this spec. It's like, because it's like I'm looking ahead. It's like, if you guys could leave me alone for 3 weeks, you could be bringing this to market. You understand that? It's like, it's just, we keep chasing after these little things, because, and it's these, you know, you keep chasing after these low percentage shots. And finally, I was like, you know what would really increase the percentage? If I was chasing these low percentage shots, and I had a spec on the market, and this is a new writing sample, and now everyone's reading me, and then even if they're not buying, they're talking, and now I'm going in for a meeting on the low percentage shot, and now I've got 3 or 4 more percentage on the dice.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, sometimes, you know, there's the juggling, but there's that also that point at which, you know, if you've got to just...
Yeah, you do have to
focus in and finish it. Yeah. And focus in and finish it.
Kevin, do you have a question?
I do have a question. I'm sorry. Yep. What is the commonality of newer writers being asked to do maybe a polish or a rewrite on other people's scripts? And is that common? Just ask that.
In terms of like a paid job or like being hired to do that?
Yeah, or even for someone to, you know, give you a chance to see how you could do. With a publisher or rewrite somebody else's work, whether it's paying or not.
I imagine most places wouldn't. I mean, they if something was far along, they would probably be a guild signatory, and they wouldn't be. Doesn't seem like that would ever, unless someone's saying purely on spec, I want to see if you got the chops to do other things. Like, so it's a more of a writing exercise, but actually to move the project forward from it's a rough script, it needs a polish, and after that. It will get made, or it gets closer to getting made. I think for hire, you know, I would say polished work, in my experience, is hard to come by because it's lucrative week to week stuff that big writers get to do. Like, I mean,
and that's
the top guys get
a lot of money and
very
short week work, because they're coming in, they're doing a week's work, and they're touching dialogue, and all they're doing is they're doing a dialogue punch.
Right, so that's stuff that's like very far along the food chain, lots of money spent, very few writers get a crack at that kind of work. So it would seem strange for me. I've never experienced anything other than they'll bring in, like, you know, I'll say to the start of my career, Scanner Darkly, Children of Men, kind of difficult novels that have difficult drafts that have been written, and they really are just looking for a cheap way to have a new body to throw at the thing and see if you can come up with something radically different. So they want you to do a ton of work for a little money, If the thing, you know, when the thing moves along the food chain and actually starts, oh, it's a good structure, oh, it's a good story, stuff starts swirling around it, then they bring in established people to take over from here to do the lighter work, even though they get paid a ton of money. They get this stamp like, it's got the Steve Zalian polish on it. Now the studio execs say, ah, we're good. You know?
That actually, in this version of the script never got made, but that actually happened. I had a project that was in pre-production that ground to a halt. And in the revision, he didn't have time to do it, but... Akiva Goldsman came on. But it was literally the thing of like, he came on, we did some notes, he took a co-producer, you know, he was going to take a, if the project made, he was going to take a co-producer credit. And it was just like, this is for Ed Pressman, and Ed Pressman was just like, he couldn't write the script, and, you know, he didn't have time to write the script, he was doing something else. But literally, it was less about his notes, which were actually very respectful. It wasn't like this huge change, but a lot of it was so that when they put on the cover page, it was, they wanted, you know, my name's still the writer, it's like, but they, like, over my name, it was like, script concept, but it was like, suddenly he had a concept. Well, it wasn't his concept, but it's like, they had to get his name on the cover.
Get his name on the page.
And again, it wasn't, they weren't even, and it's easy to sit there and go like, well, taking umbrage, it's like, they're not trying to insult me.
Yeah.
And they're not actually trying to blow smoke up Akiva Goldsman's ass. No. They're trying to get a fresh read of the material.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's like, you're not sure? Well, Akiva Goldsman is.
Right. Yeah, it's part of the... So, but does that answer the question? Are you talking about a different scenario?
I may be misinterpreting things that I've heard or just...
You know, the closer a project is to getting made, the bigger and more expensive the writers who come in are usually.
Yeah.
When things need to be broken and are, like, all the heavy coal mining needs to be done, that's how we start our group. We'll take those jobs, we'll break it for you, we'll show you that it can be a movie. Then they'll bring in bigger people to touch it up. And So most of the stuff earlier in your career is going to be the, you know, show us if this is a movie. And those are great because you prove it to them. You take something difficult and turn it into a movie they can see. They're like, ah, you know, that's someone I'm going to call again.
But that's actually an interesting thing is, and again, I'm not aware of what it's like in the mines at this point. Not that I'm so high and mighty in the salt mines. It's more like, you know, I'm actually, you know, occasionally I'm outside the fence line going, hey, what's going on in that mine, like everyone else. But it's this thing of development has dried up so much. It's like, that's kind of the job where you're a new writer, and you're taking, and again, we're assuming guild signatories.
Yeah.
So you're talking about taking guild minimum for a feature polish. And a lot of times, since you're talking about stuff that's not even budgeted, they'll just assume, we are assuming this is a low budget because it's a low budget project until it's not a low budget project.
Yeah.
So we're not even talking, we're talking about bare ass minimum fees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's a thing of even that money. It becomes a thing of, you know, if you're a new writer and you're trying to get in, it's like they may sit there and go, well, here's a project we own the rights to. It's broken. If you want to read this and spec a script, you don't have the rights to it. You can go complain, but, you know, you don't have to do this. We're not making you do this. Yeah, we're not actually giving you the job.
Yeah, it's kind of a very clever way to get everybody to do free work. I do tons of free work even now because you want the thing to be... You'll do a couple of drafts in between the official drafts because you want it to kick ass. You get one chance to blow their minds when it gets its moment in court, and you want the script to be great, so you do the extra work hoping that it's going to matter. So they have a lot of clever ways, and, you know, some that you're happy to do, but mainly that you got to look at the free work thing as a way of ultimately, if you kick ass and show them something that work will follow, that it's a way to prove yourself. I shouldn't probably say anybody be willing to do it, but if you hold the hard line that I won't work, I know plenty of my friends who don't work who hold that hard line that I will never work unless it's official and I don't want to be taken advantage of, and I love them and they're super talented, they don't work at all.
Bottom line,
they need people who can go with the flow.
And also it's a thing of to have confidence. It's like, you're not doing this because you're trying to get paid. You're doing this because you're trying to make a movie.
Yeah.
And ultimately, because a lot of the producers that you were working with and you'll work for, they're not getting paid either.
They get
paid when the, you know, it's like everyone's waiting for that green light. Because the green light, that's when they get paid.
So you're in it with
you you're in it with them. You're specking their work. They're specking their time. Everyone's specking it for the shot. And so the thing is, so it does become, I mean, those relationships are key. So it's not a thing of like, would you not do free work? It's like, yeah, you do, you'll do free work, all, but it's a thing of, what are you going to do that on? And the problem with breaking into the industry is like, you're going into an industry right now where established writers are expected to do free work. If you're trying to break into the industry and you go, well, how do I get paid? It's like, if you're coming in here to get paid, I suggest you start looking for another avenue. I mean, currently the industry has returned to an amateur industry. And I don't mean amateur in the sense of kiddies riding ponies, etc. Oh, look how cute it is. I mean amateur in the original sense of the word. You love it. If you're not here because you love it, leave. There used to be the legend back in the 90s of the guy who wrote the screenplay and sold it for $1 million, and then suddenly everyone's like, there's gold in those screenplays. Log the screenplay and sell it for $1 million. That's no, I mean, there are still people who write spec screenplays and sell them for millions of dollars, and they're established writers who are doing that. Yes?
I'm sorry, along these lines, there's a level of the industry, in quotes, that I'm not sure that's being addressed. Would your agent or manager come to you and say, these guys are looking to break this script, but they're not paying, I think you should do it, or would you like to do it, or are these things that maybe somebody comes to you directly with?
I think you know, if you have relation, usually, you know, you want a manager agent who's out. It's a pretty small business. The more I'm in it, the more I realize, shit, everybody's one degree of separation. So it's so focused. It seems giant, and it's not. So you want your agent and manager should know everything more or less that's going on. I think there's not that much going on. There's only so many assignments floating around. There's only so many players. So for the most part, you want them bringing you stuff, and it'll be kind of implied, I would say, these days, the bar for how much you have to do to even get to the starting line is pretty huge, and by then, I think they'll either have told you that, or they expect that you're comfortable with that. They wouldn't come and say, probably, oh, they're going to need a few, they're going to need a lot of, you know, they would say, are you interested, go see what they need, and what they need is, they want you to put a treatment together. They want you to maybe write the first act. They want you to fully flesh out all the beats, whatever. A lot of stuff. They'll kind of already know that. Your rep will already know that, and they'll kind of judge your appetite for whether or not you're willing to do that. But most writers who want to... The idea is you're trying to invest in your future. You're going to get paid someday. You're going to get paid well someday, but you're going to have to... This is the, you know, the investment in... these relationships. You kick ass for someone, they go on to be a good producer, or it's an established producer who says, man, this guy came up with great ideas on spec, didn't bitch about it, did it fast. Next time they have an assignment that does pay, you're gonna be stuck in their head because you kicked ass for them. That we worked for about a year doing these types of things before we got our first paycheck, and it was just a willingness, we'll crack any story. Bring it. We were just like, give us anything. We will destroy it. We will kill it. We will blow your mind, blah, blah, blah. We did that enough, so someone said, all right, let's actually hire them, because they won't go away, and they keep on giving us good outlines, and they're doing it, they're doing it, you know, kind of to with a hunger and a sense of how can we, you know, not like, oh, how can we please you, but how we want in, how we get in. We'll keep on trying till you let us in, and it just paid off at some point. So it's just a matter of just being an animal about it and saying, I know there's gold in the hills of it, and it's going to be harder to find than initially thought, but persistence just cannot be duplicated. I mean, most people get pissed off and go away long before they should have.
I got pissed off, but I stayed.
Yeah.
Which is...
Either way, just stay and keep working.
Irritate people, but it's like, well, you hate it, why don't you leave? I didn't say I hate it. Yeah. I said I hate you.
Or I have a writing partner, so I would boil over, and then I'd call him and bitch for 4 hours. and get it off my chest, just burn it all off, and then I'd go into the meetings, you know, like happy as a clam, ready to rock and roll. But you know, you go to the gym and just get it out, whatever. But don't bring that. You know, writers are generally a pretty disgruntled group, myself included. And we don't get treated well. It's not theater. You get replaced. You get underpaid, whatever. But when you break through, you get paid to sit around as a grown man and or woman and sit around and make up stories for a living. It's the best job ever. It's worth the pain in the ass, the barriers to entry. But you gotta want it, you gotta love it, and you gotta just be willing, like, I'm not going away. I'm just gonna keep on kicking this wall till something cracks and I get in there. And that kind of spirit, they're not looking for cooperative people. They're looking for, I think, most of all, they're not looking, I think the execs and producers that I've done the best work with or for is they want confidence and a sense that you are some kind of weird magician who goes to Story Mountain and comes back with secrets about. So if you say, I know how this works and I can show you and you can prove it, and it gives them confidence that the movie is not going to get them fired, or eventually people will start paying for the privilege of having you do that. But I haven't found that being a jerk helps, and I haven't found that being a dog, like a compliant, like, oh, just beat me up. And
what,
like, I don't feel like being too easygoing works either, but confident, like quiet confidence and persistence seems to be the thing that finally got us up and over.
I think one of the things that really keeps you sane during that, or is sane, I guess I should use in a relative way, but the one of the focuses is always remembering that it's not about you. Mm-hmm. It's about the story.
Yeah.
It's about the story. So if you're in a room and you're getting notes you don't like or whatever, it's like if you start getting all worked up over it, you know, and you're going to get notes like that. If you're lucky enough to start breaking into the industry and you're taking meetings with people, no one's there, you know, as a joke. I mean, it's their time. Yeah. They're there for, you know, these are things for a reason. But if you get all defensive because it's like, whatever, and that's very easy to do.
No, no.
You didn't sit there and write one version because you wanted to write the shitty version so that they can tell you what the good version. No, it's like, but one of the things that's really important is it's like, if it's about the story, and someone is giving you their thoughts, you will be able to, A, pretty much instantly, if you just keep your attention on, not on yourself, and not on your ego, but on that story, as you're getting those notes, you'll be very, very quickly be able to go, okay, you'll hear exactly, not so much, because this happens a lot with notes, you will be given a suggestion, and it's completely wrong. But when you look at the suggestion, it will give insight into, oh, this is what they didn't feel.
Right.
And the most common thing that you hear a lot of times is the character isn't likable enough. Never. You don't need to make a likable character, because otherwise, why the fuck is Quentin Tarantino living where he is, driving what he's driving, having sex with whoever he's having sex with? I don't think he's ever written a likable character.
No.
But he writes interesting people.
Yeah.
Problem is, you're not invested. Not that you didn't like them, but you didn't invest in them. Why didn't you invest in them?
Yeah.
You know, I have to find a way. You know, it's hear the note underneath the note, and if you keep your attention on your story and not on yourself, you'll be able to hear the note properly. Also, when you get a truly bad note, which in retrospect I don't get that often,
no,
but sometimes you will get a truly bad note. Not only will you be able to dismiss the note, but you'll be able to dismiss the note respectfully in the way that you won't argue from the point of view of, that's a stupid note.
Yeah.
But it's arguing from the note of, wow, you've read it with so much detail. The reason I don't think that note will work is, and then you can give this logical breakdown that has nothing to do with them, and it's everything to do with, this is the story, this is your note, now you see how this does not fit into the story.
Yeah.
What that note is fantastic for is this story over here. Would you like to pay me to write that story? Because I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
But this story is this, and, you know, there's, so there's ways of just...
Yeah, notes are, it's a skill everybody has to learn, but it's either, you know, they're a great note. The worse a note is, the bigger, before you dismiss it, look at why such a bad note could have possibly been presented to you, because probably underneath it is, they're trying to scratch an itch, they've presented you in a horrible way, but the emotion that led to that bad note is real. Listen to what it could be and why... why would they say such a thing? Because something's missing in your story.
Oh, yeah.
For what that is. So the worst notes I get, and then if they, you still don't believe in the note, if it's bullshit, if you do all the good notes and execute them brilliantly, the ones that actually make your story better, in 100% of the time, all the bad notes vanish. They are never brought up again. They don't force them down your throat. I've never had to execute a terrible note. You say 40% of these are either neutral or make this a better story. Execute those, and the bad notes kind of fall out of their own orbit by magic because they feel listened to, they see that you've invested, they feel a sense of authorship and ownership in the process, and you're actually taking their good ideas and integrating them, and then the bad notes just vanish. They just go away. You know, they'll just kind of evaporate. Because the story is now 10% better, and all their good notes found their way in. That is pretty much the way it always works. And all you got to do is turn your ego off and just listen. As everything is potentially a good idea, I'm going to listen. I'm going to write everything. I'm going to record it all, make it about the story, and then process it in a calm state of mind and look at everything as either a good note or what made this terrible note. Why'd they say this? What are they missing? And turn everything over in your head. And then still throw away the shit notes and execute only the good ones. But first just listen to everything that has to be said. And they'll love you for that too, because most people are used to writers, just the hackles go up and then, you know, you can see a writer getting pissed
Lewis
off.
Black.
You're
pissed. Lewis Black.
Yeah, you're so like seething.
You don't want to be in a, you know.
You want to work with someone like that who's going to blow up and take the whole block out? That's how writers take notes a lot. And people are scared of them because they're not pleasant to work with, and they usually aren't right. They're just being defensive. They're not like they have great ideas and you're an idiot executive. They're just pissed off that you're questioning their vision. I spent a lot of time in this, and that's a dumb note, and how dare you waste my time. And people like that, like some of my other friends, tend to stop getting the calls eventually because people don't want to work with pains in the asses when there's equally talented people who are kind of fun to work with. So they'll choose to work with a fun, good writer. And the bottom line is your story gets better. If one idea out of 100 makes your story better, then it's worth listening because you've made them happy, you've listened, you're a good collaborator, and your story got that much better, or that much better, or that much better, and you get to take credit for that. So it's a win-win. So, but yeah, I don't know if that's digressing from our core.
What is our concept? What are we talking about?
Well, it's all you got. Did you have a question a while back, or did you ask?
I don't remember, but I think it was answered.
Okay.
In terms of the original material you guys choose to work on and spec, where do you find your inspirations? Is it through articles or pictures or just experiences that happen personally to you? And then also, Mark, I'm curious, since you write with a partner, how do you two navigate which idea you're going to focus on? Mm-hmm.
I think, like, in terms of what you write originally, it just is something that won't... I just take the... since it's going to be such a brutal journey of, you know, whether I write alone or with my partner who lives in Vermont, so we have a different kind of working relationship, but it's just something that won't go away. It just haunts you. It refuses to... Not something you can sell. I tried that. For the first 5 years of working, we tried to sell every damn spec we wrote. Wrote brilliant, so-called, whatever, high concept... Couldn't get arrested with any of it, so that was clearly not our path. It's just something that will not leave you alone. You think about it every time you're scribbling ideas down. It haunts you. It has to kind of get out of you in some way. And one I just finished, I read a newspaper article in 1998, a little blurb about a nothing little tabloidy incident that stuck in my head. And I just finished 13 years later. I wrote that script. I could not shake it. I wrote it by myself because my writing partner would have thought I was out of my mind if I told him about it. But I just wrote it because I could not sort of let, it wouldn't let me be. And I love the story and I love what it could be. And I finally eked out 3 months, you know, between the jobs I have to do for to get paid and my kids getting up. I would say, you're going to sit down and write 3 pages every day and you cannot leave that chair. I don't care if you have to go to the bathroom. I don't care. You were going to do 3 pages at least before you were allowed to do anything else. I did that, and I finished the script in 3 months. But it was one that absolutely refused to go away, and I feel like that's your subconscious telling you something. And there's only a few that do that. So I feel like you don't have to think hard. It's not like you have 100 ideas that do that. You have the Frankenstein. Where did that come from? Do you even know?
Well, I mean, for me, it really boils down to, you sit there and it's like, oh, there's this movie you want to see, and then you go to Netflix, and it's not on Netflix, or you check the new, it's HBO, and you go on IMDb, and you realize, oh, I haven't seen this movie yet, because it hasn't been made yet, I better make it. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that been before, but it's like, this movie I really want to see, and I haven't seen it, and it hasn't been made.
Yeah.
So I better write it down, because it's wow, that would be such a cool thing. If I don't write it, if it hasn't been made yet, I better write it down, because then maybe I'll get paid to make it instead of
someone else will.
Yeah, because it does. It feels like for me, a lot of times these ideas, it'll be inevitable. And like the Frankenstein thing, it's like, oh, are you going to be precious with your ideas? And it's like, well, I can say Frankenstein. I mean, this is not a new story.
No.
This is an old story. People go, oh, Frankenstein. It's like, yeah, it's in the Bible. It's called Lazarus. Same shit. And it's not. These aren't. You know, people always talk about there's only so many stories, or there's no original stories. It's like, that may be true, but everybody sees a story differently.
Yeah.
And that's why they talk about, you know, if you're going to be a writer, you got to be a healthy ego. It's not just having a thick skin, but it's like, no, I think my version of the story is better. Mm-hmm. Better than mine? Yeah. If I thought yours was better, I wouldn't be sitting there spending 3 months writing my version. Well, gee, is that egotistical? Yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, one of these times, I might actually be right.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems to me that it goes back to this idea of concept. It's something that's kind of delivered by your... So, you know, when you say, I want to see that movie, well, why do you even have that thought? Like, what made you think that this... You wanted to... You were something... It was an itch. You had to scratch it. Oh, there's nothing there. Same as, you know, an idea that won't go away. It's something that I think is... I doubt you'd have to. I think any idea worth the toil of writing, it'd be weird for me to have to go in search of ideas. I want to write something. I'm gonna go read the paper and look for ideas. It seems to me like a good idea. If you're a writer, you can't. Ideas are hitting you all the time based on life, everything, like personal experiences. I found newspaper article. I mean, like. And you never know when it's going to hit you. You're just living life, and certain shit sticks in the filter of your mind and won't go away. And I don't know any writers who have to seek out ideas because they don't have any.
Yeah, that actually.
I haven't.
I don't know if you've ever encountered that, but it's the typical. It's the airport conversation when someone says, "Oh," finds out that you're writing. It's like, oh, I've got such a great idea, and we should partner so that you can write my idea.
Right.
And I'm just sitting there, and my immediate reaction is like, that's how
you're
much
a
money.
Writer, and I'm giving you an idea.
Yeah, and it's like, and how much money do you have? And which I love being, you know, because, and it obviously says, like, oh, you know, I will totally, you know, there's something that you love, you do it for free.
Yeah.
You know, you find, and this is including, you know, properties that are floating around the industry. And if someone's got Dune, it's like, no, I won't do any spec, but Dune, yeah, I'll do that for free.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing. It's like, and then, you know, you've got to, you know, apologies to anyone who's a dentist. I'm just picking on dentists. But a dentist is saying, oh, you should write my idea. And I'm like, wow, dentists make good money. Here's my studio rate. that's what I get paid. You know, if I'm going to write just your idea and you give me the idea and I'm going to do that.
But it's kind of strange the way people think. First of all, everyone, that's why I say, like, I've never met a person who found out I was a writer who doesn't have an awesome idea. And some of them are really cool, but everybody's got a story to tell. Everybody. So I feel like if you're a writer, you probably have 100 stories to tell, or a lot of stories that, you know. But everyone, I've never met anyone who doesn't have a cool story, a cool experience, a cool that they... but what's interesting is the way... Writers are perceived as these empty vessels waiting for someone to fill it up with. What a writer does is seen as rather disposable and rather, you know, you need an idea, I got one, or, you know, do you have any great ideas that you've churned out this month? As if the process is really kind of like, I'm giving you my idea, can you write it? As if you're like, thank you, now I can eat for the next year because somebody gave me an idea. Like, they don't understand the process of this is like, you know, you go into the, you all know, you go into the belly of the beast and you live and breathe and you suffer for these stories, whether they're personal, whether they're for a paycheck. And it's so not an easy process, and it's so not a casual process, but I'm amazed how little people who are not in the industry don't know that, and people who are in the industry who are directors or producers sometimes have no idea what it takes to do a really quality script. They have no idea how labor-intensive, how many versions you have to go through. It's just, it's hilarious to me as a way, just so you all know, I'm sure you've heard it plenty, this is not the theater. You will be treated with, you're just a really disposable, replaceable commodity in Hollywood. And if that sounds really depressing, I always remind myself, I get really well paid now to be treated like shit, so it softens the blow. But if you stay in it long enough, and again, are persistent and get involved with the projects you love, the people you respect, eventually some good stuff comes out the other side that you can be proud of. So it's just a persistence game and a belief game, it's a really hard job we do, and no one's ever going to appreciate it, so just take that as a given. No one's going to understand that if you do your job right as a writer, when the reviews come out, they won't talk about you, no one will read the script or see the movie and say, that movie had the best story structure I've ever experienced. They're going to say the acting was great, the dialogue was that so-and-so polished, the acting, the lighting, the directing. If a story structure is perfect, you don't see it, you don't see any footprints, fingerprints, it's just there, it's and the story is invisible. Awesome, and nobody even sees it. They just say the movie worked and it was awesome. Very few people go back and see the architecture that made that possible. So what? The movie was a success. You say, I know I had my part in that, but that's how little the people in the industry or the public understands what movie making or movie writing is about.
Or if the movie does badly.
The writer!
No, they'll say, oh, the script is bad, whatever, and at one point it's like, there's sort of the unawareness of, like, the script is bad, the story, the dialogue is bad, etc. And it's like, why did the writer make those choices? It's like, well, the writer was doing what he was told to do to get his check so that he would not be sharing credit.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, I have been in situations where I've sort of stepped into a situation and just gone, okay. It's like, do you think this is a bad decision? It's like, I'm going to try to make it the best version of this that I can. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
you have what you have.
Yeah, and no one understands that's, when they say a reviewer says, oh, I don't know what the writer was thinking. And they
get the green light.
Absolutely no idea how movies are made and how the writer's role in it is. And so that's just a given. So respect is not one of the reasons to get into this. It's to be able to tell stories, whether you're hired to adapt other people or to tell your own stories, get paid for it, and have a career and have some movies come out that you can be proud of. And that just is, it's a long journey, and it's about belief and persistence and not getting, and who cares? I mean, I don't care about respect, really. It's like, it's okay that they don't get it. I get it. I know what I do. My collaborators who are in the trenches with me know what we do. And, I don't really care about that so much anymore. Because screenwriting is such a weird job. It doesn't make any sense to people. Because the industry is so weird and the way movies are made is so weird. So it's you just want to see if the movie is good and you say, I wrote it, that's... People aren't going to say, oh, they're going to say, wow, you wrote that, cool, That's ultimately what we're trying to do, is tell some good stories that people care about and like now, and hopefully will like down the road, and still talk about.
It's also, I always think, too, that it's like, the more you write, the more the craft, actually, because you're hearing getting a little bit of a insight into the sort of, a little bit of the simmering rage that any working writers have, but it's, at the same time, it's like, well, why do you keep doing it? And it's like, because when I sit down to write at least once a day, I'm going to find this apposition between two words that I didn't expect that will give me absolute wood. It may be cut, it may not make it into a draft that anybody sees, but it's going to be like the moment to moment of taking an idea that's in your head and is therefore perfect. And with every word you're putting on it, you're limiting it. The minute you define it, you limit it. And yet through that, in the process, you're able to sit there and create something that another human being can pick up, read these words, and actually something is forming in their brain that in any way resembles what I had in mind. And then actually, I had an executive, this was a long time ago, when actually had the gall said to me, it's like, after all, it's not brain surgery. And I was like, actually it is. It is brain surgery. And it's like, and if you, and it's like, and that's your job too, because you're going to go as a producer and do an executive and convince them to make our movie. If you don't have the powers of mind control, we need another producer,
right?
Because, you know, the
you
fact
believe,
is,
yeah,
it's making a good movie. I mean, again, it's like, and this goes with every industry. It goes in the real estate industry, gambling huge amounts of money. The difference is, real estate industry development takes that land sitting there. And I've had this from my own experience, because my brother does this. Invest in a property, nothing happened for it for 13 years. 2 years ago, an apartment complex went up on it. That paid for the cost of the land. We got all our money back, plus now we get a kickback of all the rent as a percentage of everyone who owns that land. But that was 13 years. And that was 13 years of me sitting there going like, well, there goes that money. And, it, and when you're dealing with intellectual property, at 13 years later, that script is worth, well, let's see, it was worth $6 worth of paper until you actually ran it through your printer. Now it is worth, how much do we get to recycle paper? Do you get money to recycle paper?
Yeah.
And that's what it's worth. I mean, and it's shiny paper, so you can't even wipe. I mean, this really is worthless paper. It's worthless. And yet you're going to go and say, you're going to take a worthless ream of paper and go to somebody and say, I'd like a several years worth of income, please. And most of the time, they're going to say, you're out of your fucking mind. But someone is going to sit there and go, at some point go, and to cycle back to concept, they're going to look at this. You're going to satisfy their left brain enough, and their right brain is going to go, holy fuck, that's a movie. I'd pay $12 to sit for 2 hours and see this. Mm-hmm. And if I would do that, and I'm a big, important human being, other people will too. And suddenly, it's worth it.
Yeah.
Like everything. Everything is worth it. A movie, like being on a set. I mean, you know, you do all this work, and it's like, then you're on a set, and there's people there, and there's guys, and they're saying, and maybe it's the situation you created, or maybe it's some of the dialogue you wrote, maybe not, but it's like,
sets are going
they're there. Their set's going up. There is an army of people. I mean, I remember that, like, probably the biggest... The single biggest high of my professional life was I went to the set of Event Horizon, which was a substantial production, and this is back before everything was digital. And I arrived and I was exhausted and I was jet lagged, and they didn't take me to the hotel. They took me straight to the set, and this is at Pinewood, and they had James Bond Studio, which is this huge stage. And I go in and all I see is this. It's a massive plywood. It was a 50-foot massive plywood, and I couldn't see where anything was. And he's like, "Oh, go up the stairs. Paul's waiting for us." Paul Anderson, not PT, but the other Paul W. Paul W. And I go up the stairs. Paul's this really good-looking, you know, he looks like a model, and it wasn't warm, so he's wearing like this down coat. So I go up this, and I'm totally exhausted. Paul's looking over the edge, and I go over the edge, and we're looking down, and it's this huge bowl with these spikes just coming out, and there's the ball, just all the shit. I've only seen illustrations. Now it's like, it's there, and there's like 100 fucking carpenters working around. They're like, they're doing all this, and I'm just sort of looking at this. I'm jet lagged. I'm exhausted. I'm looking at it, and he looks over at me, and he's got this small grin on his face, and he looks at me, and he said, "You did this," and I loved him for that.
Yeah.
I mean,
it
was so gracious for him to give me that. And it's one of those things of, that's good for 20 years. I know, it's like, if it takes me 20 years to get another film of that scale made, fuck it, I'll do it until I'm dead. It's like someone goes, well, if you try to do this, you try to do that. It's like, no, I'll do those things too.
Mm-hmm.
But to stop going for, to see an army assembling that and trying to make it.
It's just a fantastic rush to see your goofy little words like come into the world, and the actors have to say them, and things have to be built, and it really is. You get to, it's the closest thing to, you know, really making something that it puts gas in the tank for a long time, and a lot of frustration when you know, and you'll have those along the way. The first time you get a great meeting, the first time you sell something, the first time it all incremental. But then when you get those kind of moments, then
then
you're good for like a decade, you know, to see.
Just chase the dragon for the rest of your life. It's like, no.
Because, you know, you're like, what grown people get to do this for a living? We get to sit around and be kids on a giant, real scale and get paid for it. It's kind of, you know, it takes you a long way. So it's just, you just have a lot of miles to go where and no one knows. Anyone in this room could be like months away from your huge, you just don't know. You just get in it for the long haul, for the love of it, and get on the path. You can't, you know, if you bow out because it's too hard and too frustrating, then you're guaranteed to never.
Yeah, exactly. You can't control your success, but you can control your failure.
Totally, yeah.
You can ensure your failure.
Yeah.
You can always ensure your failure.
Yeah.
It's like, and someone, I remember I just didn't go, well, how do I know if I'm wasting my time writing? It's like, well, if you die and you haven't sold anything, then you know.
Exactly. Yeah, so it is, you know, it is worth the journey. And, you know, I'd say most people at Cinesory probably already passed that why or why do this. It's kind of like you can't not do it. I think that's the best answer I've ever heard.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, why do I do it? It's like, what a weird question, you know. And anyone who says, well, because I have the strategy of, and I feel like I could go into banking, but this seems like it could be a long...
If you could, you will.
Yeah, you exactly, will. Yeah.
It's like, there's no one who's not...
Ever,
yeah, but it's true. It's like, if you can do anything else with your life,
yeah.
No matter how successful you are, as a writer in Hollywood, everything's cyclical, and you'll end up going through a patch.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you're getting the jobs, I mean, you're getting the jobs, but you're getting no joy. And you'll be sitting there, do I want to do this with my life? Am I doing this? It's like, yeah, I'm going to work, but it's like, and it's not about the money, it's about this, like, and you go through this whole, and then you sit there and go, well, okay, what else do I want to do? And it's like, for me, it was like, would I do this, or I can be the captain of the ballistic missile sub? And I won't pass that psychological profile down to it. So that's it. So those are your choices.
You're in.
Mark, thank you very, very much.
If you missed out on your chance to apply for the 2013 retreat, never fear. Entries for the 2014 Cinestory Screenwriting Awards and Fellowship open on October 1st. More details at cinestory.org/contest. Cinestory would like to thank Don Bowden for use of the track Home from his album This One's Gonna Leave a Mark. Don is a composer for film, TV and other media. To find out more about Don's work, visit donbowden.com. And finally, Cinestory is a non-profit organization. So if you like what you hear, consider supporting Cinestory and these podcasts by making a donation at cinestory.org/support us. Until next time, happy writing.